From Social Service to SG, I'm Jing Yao. Last year, the Lian Center for Social Innovation published Singapore's first nationally representative food insecurity study, finding that about 10% of Singaporean households experienced food insecurity at least once in the last 12 months. This year, the center's updated second part of the Hunger Report explored two related questions. First, what is the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on food insecurity in Singapore? And second, how can the unique needs of food insecure families be met? We take a deeper dive into the report with members of the report team, Dr. Delvin Sidhu, Dr. Tanya Nagpour, and Ms. Ng Wing Lin. Maybe before we start, I want to first remind listeners about the first Hunger Report that was published by the Lian Center last year, right? So in that nationally representative study, your team found that about 10% of the Singaporean households experienced food insecurity at least once in the last 12 months, and only 22% of those food insecure households were receiving food support from an organization. So today, I was really excited to speak to the three of you again because we focused on your update to that report focusing on the pandemic or COVID-19's impact on food insecure houses in Singapore. And the Hunger Report 2, I should note, was commissioned by the Food Bank Singapore and supported by Enterprise Tolerance as well. So maybe before we start, could you tell us a bit more about how this study came about?
Okay, sure, Danielle. So how did this piece of research come about? In 2019, LCSI was commissioned by Food Bank Singapore to conduct the first nationally representative study to investigate the prevalence of food insecurity in the local context, because at the time, there was no national statistic on the prevalence of food insecurity in Singapore. So we published a Hunger Report 1 in 2020, and that was during the thick of the COVID-19 pandemic. Right. So what did we find from the Hunger Report 2020? So two key takeaways. First, as you very rightfully pointed out, Danielle, 10.4% of the 1,200 participants who participated experienced food insecurity at least once in the last 12 months at the time of which they completed the survey. But what we also found was that there were misalignment in the food support given to households based on factors like one's ability to cook, mobility issues, cultural mismatches, dietary restrictions, right? So basically, families were not able to convert the food support that they received into actual meals. What happened a few months after we finished collecting the data, completing the survey for the Hunger Report in 2019 was when COVID struck, right? So the world came to a standstill. There were snap lockdowns. And in Singapore, we had the circuit breaker and we had the possibility of more circuit breakers, right? It became very common. So in 2021, we were commissioned by Food Bank Singapore again to embark on the Hunger Report 2. Why? Because we wanted to zoom into the experiences of the previously identified food insecure households. And we were in a position to do that because we had already collected their pre-COVID data. So the objective of the second Hunger Report is to focus on the two key takeaways that I highlighted previously from Hunger Report 1. So we conducted Hunger Report 2 in two phases. First, we really wanted to understand what is the impact of COVID-19 on food insecure households in Singapore. And we chose food insecure households because they were a vulnerable group to begin with, right? And we already had identified them pre-COVID. Secondly, we also wanted to put into action a recommendation that we ourselves had put forward in the original report about really tackling the misalignment of food support through an intervention. So we created an intervention to test and see if we are able to understand how the unique needs of each food insecure family can be met.
Yeah. And that's really helpful, Delvin, because I think that got me really excited when I read the report and saw the intervention part of it, right? The two parts. I think the first part a lot of folks were watching out for. But I think the second one is something that we'll dive deeper into as well. I should also mention informally for folks who are listening, I should also mention one, I would say a third contribution from Hunger Report One was, I know informally on the ground, social service agencies going to your report and looking at how to assess with the beneficiaries they're working with, the extent of food insecurity, right? So they're using, so last episode, we talked in great detail about how to measure what the cutoff points were. So I should also briefly share that a lot of the agencies I work with are starting to use some of those instrumentals. And I think that's a huge contribution in terms of assessing how their beneficiaries might be food insecure or food secure. So, yeah. But okay. Also, yeah, and because that's a great kind of segue to go to Tanya, because I was wondering, we could also remind listeners here, what do we mean when we say a household is food insecure in that sense?
Okay, Jinyao. So yeah, it's always good to set the record right and, you know, really try and define this core concept that we're talking about, which is food insecurity. And food insecurity actually is said to come about when a particular family or a household does not have or is not even confident of having economic or physical access to sufficient food and to even acceptable food for a healthy life. Now, generally what happens is that when anyone says the word food insecurity, it conjures up an image of malnutrition or even hunger for that matter, right? However, the way we see food insecurity, it is not just an absence of hunger. In fact, it is a very nuanced concept that involves the idea of safe, nutritious, and healthy food. So let me give you an example. Let's say there is a family that is getting by with eating instant noodles, biscuits, or rice porridge, right, day in and day out. We would consider them a food insecure family because this kind of dietary pattern is in no respect a healthy one to be, you know, going on for a prolonged period of time. So even though this family is being able to secure food and is not feeling hungry, so to say, but we would still consider them as a food insecure household.
And with that in mind, and we will dive into the report itself, before your team started contacting the food insecure households for this follow-up study, what were some of the hypothesized effects of COVID? So what did you imagine were the effects of COVID-19? I guess another way of asking the question is, how do we think the pandemic would have affected those who were already food insecure in the country?
So like Dalvin mentioned earlier, this was one of the primary reasons we reckoned that as an aftermath to the circuit breaker period during the pandemic, there were families who were already food insecure and these may have, their condition may have worsened and they may have greater number of struggles in order to have their food needs met. And in fact, we also did a review of literature of very recent studies that were done between 2020 and 2021. And we found that COVID did have an impact on food insecurity of vulnerable households. In fact, several international organizations such as World Bank and even the UN Food Program came up with estimates that a significant number of people were either running out of food or were reducing their consumption. So we reckon that this situation would obviously have exacerbated for the previously identified food insecure families that we had interviewed in Hunger Report 1. So it was a very natural decision for us to at least be able to go back to these families and check on them and see what is the outcome for them over this last 1 year.
Yeah, which is what the team did, right? Because there were about 145 food insecure households from Hunger Report 1, and you invited about 59 to participate in the second one. And so I really like the study report because it's organized quite clearly in two phases, right? So we can take them in turn. And the first question, which relates directly to Tanya, what you shared about the hypothesis would be, the question I will quote, what is the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on food insecurity in Singapore, right? So could you, in this vein, highlight the main findings in terms of the change in their food security status, whether the households, these 59 households, fared better or worse, and the support that these households received?
Sure. So we start with the good news first. So good news is that about 44.1% of our participants had some form of improvement in their food security status. So when we say some form of improvement, basically we mean that they have moved at least one category up. So they have improved by one category. So we're talking about a movement from severely food insecure to now moderately food insecure, because that's an improvement. Moderately food insecure to now food secure. And for some, they were even able to move two categories up from severely food insecure to now food secure. So when we delve into the specific food statuses, right, we actually also found that 20.3% of our sample are actually now in the food secure category, right? So what are some of these possible reasons why these households were previously identified as food insecure in 2019? How were they able to now join the food secure category? Right. Well, we did track some of the changes in their survey responses in 2019 versus now. And what we found is that this is mainly because of an increase in income. So they were able, these were the households who were able to take advantages of some of the opportunities that were afforded during the pandemic. But they have been, or, you know, and continued receiving food support as well. So these are, you know, some of the reasons why some families were able to jump into the food secure category in the midst of a pandemic. We have bad news as well, that 10.2% of our households actually worsened in their food security status. So basically, this means that they were previously identified as moderately food insecure in 2019, pre-COVID. And in the midst of the pandemic, they have gone down to now severely food insecure. So I think this is a finding that we really want to really highlight, because, you know, 10.2% of our households have worsened in their food security status. 45.8% of our households actually remain status quo. So there was no change in their food security status. Unfortunately, in terms of food support, the large proportion of our participants and households were still not receiving any form of food support. So 71% of our households were not receiving any form of food support.
Yeah, and which is concerning, right? Because if they are food insecure, you imagine that would be one of the interventions or treatments, which logically links the second part of the study, which I found to be really interesting, because I'm really interested in investor interventions and treatments, right? So the second question I quote would be, how can the unique needs of these food insecure families be met? And I imagine, in drawing upon what Delvin, you mentioned, right, would be especially those that either were in the status quo or those who had the conditions worsened also. So Wing, then maybe tell us about, you know, how, what exactly was the intervention? How was it developed? How was it administered? And I think also it was mentioned and alluded to in the report that Food Bank Singapore was part of this support also. So tell us more about the process.
So as mentioned, phase two of this study was about meeting the unique needs of the previously identified food insecure families. So Delvin already mentioned this a bit just now, but it basically puts into action the most urgent recommendation made in the first hunger report, which was that there was a misalignment in the provision of food support. So we found that food support was not really reaching where it was required the most, and that when it was, it also tended to be incongruent with the unique needs of the households that they were helping. So for example, dry rations were given to an elderly person living alone with no means to cook, or they could have had mobility issues, time constraints, such that they couldn't utilize what was given to them properly. Or perhaps the meals given to the families were culturally mismatched or didn't fit in with their dietary restrictions. So in order to tackle this misalignment, the intervention that we developed was the administration of what we call the needs toolkit, which was basically a survey used to assess the unique food needs of each household. So the aim of this survey was to ensure that they would receive the appropriate type of food support based on the needs that they indicated in the survey. So this test was conducted by the same field interviewers who administered the other tests. Yeah, so as you mentioned just now, during this phase, we worked a lot with the food bank to come up with questions to make sure that the information that we were asking the participants was actually useful and important for them to know as a food support organization, because they will be the ones who would try to connect the food support to them after that. So we asked questions and took into account things like household information, you know, their size, monthly expenditure, whether there were children in the household, their preferences for food, also preferences for the type of food support that they wanted to receive. So based on the preferences indicated through this needs toolkit, we then provided targeted food support. So this came in the form of either cooked meals for those who weren't able to cook by themselves, or NTUC supermarket vouchers, which is what the majority of our respondents opted for.
That's really handy because it's kind of like a two-step process, right? First, using the needs toolkit, and then second, where you have either warm meals or cooked meals with the supermarket voucher. So I guess the natural question whenever we talk about intervention would be, what are the outcomes or impact, right? So what were the observable kind of outcomes and impact with the food insecure households? I think the report framed it as, I quote unquote, value of autonomy in food support. And I was hoping you could speak to, the team could speak to that in that sense.
Yeah, I'll take that, Jinhao. So in terms of the impact of the intervention, we were very encouraged to see that about 23.5% of the households who had actually participated in phase two of the study and were actually even previously assessed to be food insecure had now moved up one or two grades and had become food secure. So we were very encouraged with that. And the salutary effects of this intervention actually extended beyond just feeling being food secure. They also reported lower distress levels, significantly lower distress levels between pre-intervention and post-intervention. And most importantly to us was the fact that they were very satisfied with the support, right? In fact, when we compared the satisfaction levels to Hunger Report 1 or even to pre-intervention in Hunger Report 2, there was a marked improvement in the satisfaction levels. In fact, 76% of them were extremely satisfied and the remaining were somewhat satisfied. So this was very encouraging to us. And naturally, the reasons for this high level of satisfaction was because now they could purchase whatever they needed for their families without having to depend on anyone, right? So that, and also I would like to draw the listeners' attention to the verbatim quotes that we have placed in the report itself, which actually speak volumes about this value of autonomy that you were just speaking of, right? So why is this autonomy so important to our recipients, to our beneficiaries? I think the reason why I think this has worked is because it helped the families to be experts of their own needs and conditions, right? So they told us what they needed and we gave them what they needed. Right. So there was an excellent alignment between the need and the support, number one. And number two was that they got ownership on their food choices and their food routines by this method. So for two months, they were getting this this sort of support. And over the 2 month period, they had the freedom to actually utilize these vouchers as they please, as per the needs or the unique needs of their families. And also it overcame challenges around embarrassment that had been spoken about in Hunger Report 1 when we asked our recipients or our participants that, you know, why are you not asking for food support? They said, we're just embarrassed to do so, right? And then there was ad hoc support or there was cultural mismatches, taste preferences could not be kept into account, right? But in this way, they took ownership and they were able to utilize this sort of support in the way that was most effective for them. So that was really the most, I think, nice, I would say, and most encouraging aspect of this intervention for us.
Yeah, I know Wingnan is going to speak to the spending trends differences, but I wish the what you said could be heard by a lot of the agencies in that sense, right? Because so many key terms that came up when you're sharing in terms of autonomy, in terms of seeing them as the expert, in terms of them deciding in that sense. I think the other value, of course, is about communicating the needs to the team based on needs analysis. But I think what it also allows the families and households to do is to kind of think about their own needs also, right? So it allows them to frame what's needed. Then this is not just unique, just food insecure households, right? Anyone who has to do the groceries for the week knows you have to take a bit of effort to kind of plan for these different things. And knowing what you want is really quite important in that process also. Yeah, sorry, Wingnan, I know you were going to speak to the spending trends.
Yeah, so we actually analyzed their spending trends based on the NTUC voucher receipts that they submitted. So as you said, we really wanted to understand, you know, how they were spending their money and what kind of items that they were spending their money on. So we actually found that 78.3% of the total spending was on food items and a substantial amount, 18.6%, was on non-food items, such as toiletries and cleaning materials, things like that. And the remaining 3.1% consisted of items that we weren't able to identify from the receipts alone. So we categorized the food items based on food categories that we took from the 2017 and 18 household expenditure survey, which was conducted by the Singapore Department of Statistics. And it looked at the monthly expenditure of average Singaporean households. So we found out that the top four food categories in our spending trends analysis were the same as the top four categories as those in the household expenditure survey, which was an indication for us that our sample's purchases were in line with that of the average Singaporean household. So, you know, that confirmed for us that NTUC vouchers were utilized on items that they actually needed. You know, as Tanya said, it was giving them the level of autonomy to buy the items that they would actually use on a regular basis, you know, the brands that they like, the things that they would actually eat, given their specific needs and lifestyles, and including non-food necessities.
And I would imagine a lot of the non-food necessities are complementary to those needs as well. And I guess this leads us to kind of like the final question, which is that intervention you talked about, the needs analysis and then the supermarket vouchers, coalesce into two big recommendations from the report. First, again, on the need of full autonomy in Singapore's food support network or model. And the second one will be partnerships in the food support ecosystem. So maybe, Delvin, tell us more about each of these two recommendations as well as the progress you would like to see in the future. And I will maybe also sneak in one more question here and ask you, is there plans for Hunger Report Part 3 to extend upon some of these findings or not? Yeah.
Okay, so on your first, on our first recommendation on autonomy, so this study really highlights the importance of understanding the specific needs of food insecure households and the value of autonomy in food support, right? So the households in our study were empowered, right, first to choose the type of food support they would receive, and then have the freedom for those who chose NTUC vouchers to purchase groceries and their own choice of groceries. This approach did two things. We were able to achieve two things. First, we were able to meet their food needs more appropriately. And at the same time, we were able to afford households a sense of dignity and ownership over their choices, right? And what you will see in the report is that the spending trends actually show that the spending of the supermarket vouchers by food insecure households were actually very similar to that of the average Singaporean households. So to answer your question on progress, our hope is that food charities on the ground would actually download our needs toolkit that is available in our report, try it out, see if they are able to administer it, and decipher if it's useful for them when they are trying to assess the needs of their beneficiaries. And we actually, for the needs toolkit, it's something that the researchers ourselves administered to our food insecure households, and we found it to be able to be administered via the phone. You can do it face-to-face. It was actually quite easy to use. And at the end of the needs toolkit, we were able to make an assessment on what is the appropriate type of food needs that this family requires and the amount, what is adequate. You know, what's the household size? Is there children in the household? So our hope is that the food charities on the ground actually download the needs toolkit and have a try. Second recommendation is that there is a need for multi-sector partnerships. Why? This is because we found from analyzing the receipts that those who chose supermarket vouchers actually spent a substantial amount, 18.6%, as Wong Lin said, on non-food items, such as toiletries and cleaning materials. So there is a demand for these types of goods, right? So food support organizations on the ground might find it very challenging to provide such an array of support, food items as well as non-food items. But this can actually be overcome through partnerships and collaborations, you know, between different organizations will allow them to come together, pool their resources together for the common good and provide beneficiaries with the more holistic and targeted support. So about your question about Hunger Report 3, at the moment, there are no plans yet, but we hope that we will be able to publish, look into our Hunger Report 2 and craft out something for Hunger Report 3. So at the immediate moment, we don't have plans yet, but we hope that will change in the future.
I'm hoping, and this is my bias and links to what you said, I'm hoping more agencies will actually pick up both the toolkit and the assessment of insecurity, right? Because I think they go hand in hand and actually see how this goes. So administering the intervention and multiple sites and seeing how that works out across Singapore. So I think that'll be really interesting to look at. So hopefully we'll be able to see something down the road like that also.
That's the main reason why we had published our needs toolkit with our report as well, because we wanted it to be used on the ground as well instead of something that was just used for the study.
Yeah. And I should mention at this last point, before thanking the guests, that both the first report and the second report will be linked in the show notes. Please download the report. The first report, you can look at the inventory of items they've used for to assess food insecurity. And the second one contains, of course, the needs toolkit as well. And with that, you know, it's always a joy talking to the team. I think the research on food insecurity is really helpful for agencies and practitioners on the ground. And I think they really appreciate the insights you've given so far. So thank you for being on, and all the best with future endeavors in the center and with your projects too. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Jinya. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.